Sunday school curriculum. But also just kind of so you know, none of it goes to me. So I wrote this Sunday school curriculum, and I don't even get like per diem or anything. No, but maybe that'll make you give more, just to know that it doesn't actually go to me. But I am very excited. I hate to admit that I had a hard time focusing this spring in because I've been looking forward to teaching this series of Sunday school for not just the past couple months when Pastor and I first started organizing this, but actually for the past several years. It's been something that I've talked to my wife about a lot. I've talked to her father about a lot. I've talked to my own dad about a lot. And so this is definitely a labor of love. I've had a lot of these thoughts running around in my head for a very, very long time, pretty much ever since I've been in college in those 4 years that I spent at Bob Jones and the three following years that I spent at Sterling College, and just kind of compiling all of the knowledge that I had taken from my professors and using that as a research for the American Revolution. So I'm excited to get started. Couple things that I want to hit before we officially cover our content, and these are requests from somebody who actually teaches, so it's going to sound like you guys are in class, but in actuality, that's kind of what this is, because it's not, we actually will not have a whole lot of biblical texts, and Pastor wanted it that way. This is more of a opportunity for us to learn in a religious environment, but we're learning secular curriculum. So just kind of so what you know is coming down the line here. But I do have a kind of a strange request. All of these lessons are recorded, and so I don't want any personal recording of it, and there's really one main reason for that. And the reason is that I have an education job that is apart from the church, and so if for whatever reason I don't have the ability to control how this gets out, I would hate for my employers at Well District RE3J to think that I am filling this role in capacity as a teacher for the district. I am not doing that. I am not a teacher for Well District RE3J this morning. I am a Sunday school superintendent at Westside Baptist Church. So what that helps doing, and obviously my district is not going to have an issue with me teaching Sunday school, but if it's on the church website, it's in a religious context, and everyone understands that I'm filling this role in that capacity, as opposed to thinking one of the teachers at Weld Central High School is you know, teaching history at a church. That just kind of shows a conflict of interest, and so that would help me out if we could kind of keep the recording to the church website. I do want you guys to understand our purpose, and I already touched on this a little bit. Again, this is not a biblical look into the American Revolution, because that role is reserved for pastor, which I am very grateful for. I am trained in history and civics and government. I am not trained and do not have near the experience that pastor has in applying that stuff to biblical passages. So while I think it was last summer, we did have kind of a biblical emphasis in talking about the Christian's relationship to government, this is a for all intents and purposes, a six-week historical course for the people at Westside Baptist Church to get a full understanding of history and the legal ramifications of the American Revolution. So please understand that that's what it is. The last thing I wanted to point out, actually, I guess I have one other thing about questions and comments, but I did want to point out that we're in kind of a unique position. As I've already mentioned, I am a teacher, but I'm not filling this role as a teacher. But I would like you guys to understand, and I don't want to come across as prideful when I say this. I do want you to understand that I have years and years of study and experience with this content. And while there's a lot of people that have a great fascination, and I'm looking forward very much to our time of questions and comments, please understand that what I am presenting to you is coming from maybe a little bit more of a professional position. This is not like just a hobby for me or something that I do on the side. And so this is factual. Everything that I present to you this morning is going to be factual and completely objective. How we apply it might be subjective, but understand I'm from a professional point of view, I'm looking at this as this is concrete history and some of this stuff may actually just not be up for discussion. So you may, and I don't think we're going to have any issues with that here, but I wanted to mention it. If you want to debate about whether John Locke was actually an historical philosopher, that's not up for debate. Historically, he was. Okay, so there's some stuff that's just factually, historically true, and there's other stuff that I think we're going to have a great opportunity for questions and discussions. Because of that, because of the amount of content that I have to get through, though, we may kind of have to piece together some of the lessons. We'll have maybe 10 minutes for questions and comments. Other times, we may kind of run into the end of it, and I'll take all the time talking to you myself. But just kind of so you know what's coming. All right, we're going to start from pretty much the very beginning of American revolutionary thought. And this goes all the way back to a period of philosophical ideas back in the 16 and 1700s. And this philosophical time period is known as the Enlightenment. Okay, and this is focusing on logic and reason. And the reason that it's known as the Enlightenment is because people are beginning to think outside of the historical and cultural norms of Europe. So prior to the Enlightenment, and even during the Enlightenment, you have nation states in Europe that are unifying, and they're all unifying for the most part under one royal family. So for example, in the country of in the 1500s, the 15 and 1600s, the Bourbon royal family, or Bourbon, if you're a Francophile and want it pronounced correctly, but the Bourbon royal family has consolidated governmental power within their family, and they are reigning as the monarchs of France. And so this is where you get all the enumerated Louis and so forth, and the strong emphasis of the Roman Catholic Church in France. But prior to that, you just have a noble family, a landowning, wealthy family, known as the Bourbons, who are ruling a large territory. And that territory becomes larger and larger and larger until you roughly get the borders that we know today as the country of France. And this is happening all across Europe through this time. And the most popular way for these countries, these nation states, to set up governments is with monarchs. And those monarchs are going to have a very, very close relationship to whatever the state church is. And we've already mentioned that France's state church is going to be the Roman Catholic Church. Well, with Henry VIII in England, England kind of goes its own route because Henry, well, that's a conversation for another time. But he wanted his own church, so he wasn't accountable for the Roman Catholic Church. And so that's where you get the foundation of the Anglican Church. Okay. But all of these nation states have close relationship with a state church, and philosophical thought and philosophical ideas are controlled very tightly by those organizations. The king controls, and this is the absolute monarchies where the king possesses all of the power of government. There are no three branches. That's actually something we'll talk about. It's an Enlightenment philosopher that comes up with that idea. All of the governmental power rests within the king. And the way that he justifies that is through the idea of divine right, the divine right of kings. And that's going to be something we talk about a little bit later. But just so you kind of know what the general environment is that allows the philosophy of the Enlightenment to take root. So you have a very, very controlled realm of science, a very controlled realm of philosophy, and naturally you're going to get a lot of pushback against that. And eventually people are going to start wondering what society and what government would look like apart from the way things have been set up for, at this point, thousands of years, with the Roman Catholic Church having a strong control over the kings, and then the kings thereby having so much of the control that they justify through the divine right, that God has given me this power, and so now I'm going to exercise it. So a lot of these theories are going to focus on sociology, and sociology is essentially just the study of how people interact with each other in groups. Okay, so to kind of break that down simply, you have like a geographical sociology, which I think is fascinating. That is how people interact with each other in regards to where they're located. And you would not believe how much of an emphasis and how much people change just based on their geographical location. It dictates nearly everything, right? Resources and even religions and things like that. It's fascinating. But most of those theories are going to focus on those things. And civics is just the study of government, essentially. So how do humans interact with each other in society? How do they interact with those societal norms? Do they accept those? And how do humans interact with that governing body? Okay, so how are they going to interact with each other? And how are they going to interact with the people that are in charge of them? And with a lot of the faults that I'm sure a lot of you can point to without me even explaining them, the faults in the Roman Catholic Church and the faults with having one person in charge of everything, you're going to get a lot of people thinking, is there a different way that we can do this? And how can we branch out, and what are some ideas that can change the issues that we have? So one of the first Enlightenment philosopher that we're going to talk about, and one of the first in this movement, is Thomas Hobbes. He's the author of the book that's known as The Leviathan. And in fact, this picture is, some of you may be able to read the bottom there, Leviathan. That's the cover of his book. A couple points about the cover. You can see that a leviathan, or the giant creature that you guys know about, because even in Job, it's, and I think in Psalms, the Bible talks about leviathan. The person, or the being that's the leviathan, according to Thomas Hobbes, is the monarch. And you can't tell, it just looks like chainmail from here, but what he is made up of is little people. Okay? And they make up his torso and his arms, and then you have the staff, which symbolizes his government power, and then the sword, which symbolizes his policing power or his military power. And then he is lording over the landscape on the cover of that book. So this is Thomas Hobbes' idea about how government should be set up. He's the first, one of the first philosophers to think about the idea of a social contract. The social contract is so important for you to understand when we talk about the American Revolution. A social contract means that the way in which governments are set up is through a contract of people with their government. The people contractually give up their freedom as individuals in exchange for the peace and the security that a government provides to them. So we could, as individuals, and this will get explained even more in the next bullet point about John Locke, as individuals, you may believe that you have certain rights, and that within those rights, you could do pretty much whatever you want. But we're going to give up some of those rights so that we can have peace and prosperity. Because otherwise, what's going to happen is Gio's going to have something that I want, and I'm just going to take it. And I have the freedom to do that as a human, because there's nothing actually physically restricting me from it. But because Gio wants to live in peace, and he wants to keep his stuff, and I look at it from his point of view, and I go, I don't want anybody taking my stuff. I'm going to relinquish my freedom to take what I want by force, and then let a governing body decide, no, that's illegal, and we're going to punish those types of actions. And so you can see how this idea is going to branch out into a bunch of different concepts, and how much freedom are we actually going to give up to our government in exchange for our security. Okay? And that's thinking of a lot of other Enlightenment philosophers. The interesting thing about Thomas Hobbes is he's actually pro-monarchy. He believes that man is inherently evil, which everyone in this room also believes. But because man is inherently evil, he believes that you have to have someone, or at least a government, that is extremely powerful and powerful enough to constrict that evil nature of its citizens. So Hobbes says, yes, you have this contract between a lot of people to a few people and how you're going to have an organized society. But the best way to form that, and the most efficient way, in Hobbes' estimation, is a monarchy. And certainly in the sense of convenience and efficiency. A monarchy is the most convenient and the most efficient because you have one person where the buck stops, always. And you don't have to wait on the Senate to ratify the bill that the House of Representatives passed. You don't have to wait on the Prime Minister to form a government in a parliamentary government. You just have one person. I'm in charge. If you want to complain about it, then we can fight. And I'll probably win because I have a bunch of money and a bunch of people loyal to me. And then you're just going to end up doing whatever I want in the end anyway. So there is some efficiency with it. And Hobbes based that belief, as I said, on the fact that humans are inherently evil. Secondly, we have John Locke, which I think is probably a very familiar name, maybe even more so than Thomas Hobbes. He was the author of several books, but one of them, the most famous, is Two Treatises of Government. And Locke's big idea, if there's one thing I want you to know about John Locke, it's his idea of man. So these rights are defined as natural because he believes every man is born with them inherently. And there's three of those rights. And they're not going to come up on the screen, so if you're taking notes, the three rights, life, liberty, and everybody says the pursuit of happiness, wrong. Life, liberty, and property, according to John Locke. Okay, life, liberty, and property. So every human, inherently, because they were born, has the right to continue to exist until natural causes result in them not existing anymore, is essentially what Locke is saying. So you have the right, as a human, when you're born, to continue to live. Okay, that life has been granted to you, and Locke believes in a creator. So because life has been granted to you by a creator, you have the right to continue to live. That makes sense. Liberty, the right to make decisions on your own for what you believe is in your own best interests. Now, of course, that's going to be contained by certain laws, and Locke is not an anarchist. But when decisions are confined to things that are just going to affect you, you have the right to make those decisions yourself. And I think everybody in here would agree with that. I was just talking with Jamie when we pulled into church. We were talking about baby seats and booster seats and all this kind of stuff. And now, a lot of you probably know the laws better than I do, and that's bad. That's a bad thing. But like, some kids are in booster seats until they're like 7 years old. When I was like 5 or 6, I was using a regular seatbelt, and it was no big deal, right? And I think pastors told stories of him like standing up behind the seat of his, you know, parents' station wagon. And laws have just changed so much. In my estimation, it is my liberty to decide whether or not my 5-year-old sits in the front seat of my truck with me and uses an adult seatbelt, or uses a booster seat. Now, this would be an example of where my opinion and my application of the principle of natural rights, it's my liberty to decide that. It's my liberty to decide whether I wear a seatbelt or not. Me not wearing a seatbelt has little to do with the safety of anyone else. In fact, it has nothing to do with anyone else's safety. It's my decision. So if it has to do with my safety, why would I let somebody else make that decision for me? Now, does that mean I'm not going to wear a seatbelt? Well, sometimes. But for the most part, yeah, I still wear my seatbelt because I know that I'm doing so. But that's a personal decision. And personally, once again, we can have conversations with this afterwards. Personally, I don't think that there should be a law telling me how to live safely because my safety is my own problem. Okay? Property is going to be the one part of Locke's natural rights that will be very controversial. I tend to agree with him that property should be a natural right of man. That because you are on this earth, you should be allotted property. Now, the issue with this is who's going to make sure that you get the property that's due you? And this is where I'm not sure how you do it. Because you'd have to have a government power that would be distributing property, and that would mean the government would own the property, which would mean that the people didn't own the property. So that's a problem. I think the best application of this is probably that everyone has the right to own property as opposed to the right to automatically claim property. So the right of property ownership is inherent with man simply because he inhabits the earth. Okay, and there's some biblical application for that. In Genesis, God talking about how he wants man to be fruitful, multiply, tame and inhabit the earth. That's you know, something that might be able to apply to this general idea. So property is a tricky one, and that's why Thomas Jefferson left it out of the Declaration of Independence. How do we feel about people naturally having the right to own property? All right, third, we have Voltaire. And some of these philosophers have super long French names, and so I just use their pen name and the name that they're most commonly known as. So Voltaire, he's going to emphasize intellectual and civic liberty, essentially freedom of thought and freedom of speech. That's the intellectual liberty. Civic liberty is the liberty from a government body oppressing you to the point where you don't have control over your own life. And Voltaire also theorizes about, he's kind of the father of civil libertarianism, which is libertarianism as a concept is an idea that I have kind of found myself gravitating more and more towards. Now, I don't want to advocate in here for the Libertarian Party or anything like that, because there's plenty of things on their platform that I personally don't agree with. But if you look at the basis of libertarianism, it is providing more power to an individual and to individual local governing bodies than it is to a higher federal or national governing authority. So Voltaire believes that for intellectual liberty and civic liberty to be accurate and fruitful, you need civil libertarianism to the point of people being not even really noticing or feeling any sort of oppression from my government. I have the opportunity and the right in the United States to speak essentially whatever I want. And I tell my kids in class this sometimes. I say, you can't be punished like in a federal court for saying that you're going to commit a crime. It's like I could tell somebody I'm going to kill you, but that's freedom of speech. And there's things in within that will get you into trouble. Okay, so like if one of my students threatens me in a school, they're going to get in trouble. And they could say, well, I have freedom of speech. Well, no, because you're in a business, you're in a local area that's going to constrict that. And there's some people that you could threaten, like you could threaten the president of the United States. That's not going to fall under freedom of speech. But in a lot of ways, people go, well, how can somebody get up in front of a crowd of thousands of people and spout a bunch of racist garbage like the KKK does, or did, doesn't anymore for the most part. But how can they get up and say all that stuff, and they talk about lynching and disobeying federal law, and they do all that stuff, but nobody stops them? Well, because it's freedom of speech. That organization is allowed to exist. But what happens when the lynching actually occurs? Is that illegal? Yes. So talking about it and doing it are two very different things. And so Voltaire wants people to understand that the discussion has to take place. And for discussions to freely take place, there has to be more liberty in speech than there is for actions. Okay. So there's a very sharp contrast with what you can get arrested for based on what you say and based on what you actually do. Okay? Saying and doing are two very, very different things, especially from a legal perspective. We'll take a little bit more time and talk about Rousseau. I have a few more points on him. So he also theorizes about the social contract, and this is a quote from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. They write, "The concern that dominates Rousseau's work is to find a way of preserving human freedom in a world where human beings are increasingly dependent on one another satisfaction of their needs." How true is that today? This guy's writing about this in the 1700s. "In the modern world, human beings come to derive their very sense of self from the opinion of others, a fact which Rousseau sees as corrosive of freedom and destructive of individual authenticity." Would you agree with that? I think it's a very apt writing and an apt application of Rousseau's philosophical beliefs. So just kind of breaking that quote down a little bit. In the modern world, are we becoming more or less dependent on other people for our needs? Probably more. And some of that is voluntary and not forced, but when you get into issues like security, personal security, when you get into issues like healthcare, when you get into issues of you know, other things that people are saying are the right of someone, the right of safety, and how does that apply and what does that actually look like when we're writing laws? Are we willing to become more and more dependent on other people? We could even put the government in there. Are we willing to become more and more dependent on other government people to provide that for us? Or do we understand that there is a strong risk in relying on someone else to provide something that we ourselves need? It's becoming more and more apparent to me that I don't even know, like in Kersey, I have full faith that the police department there is going to keep me safe. But if I go to Denver, do I have full faith that the Denver Police Department is going to keep me safe if there's a Black Lives Matter march? No. And so what do I feel is my responsibility? Well, if I can carry a weapon, I'm going to. Because I'm not going to rely on someone else for my safety and the safety of my wife. And even in the area where I feel like I'm pretty safe, like even church sometimes, am I relying on all of you to provide for my safety and my wife's safety? Of course not. Okay. Now, I assume that there'd be people here who would make and have already made great sacrifices for the both of us. But when it comes to personal safety, I would expect Mr. Kurt to protect his wife before he protected mine, or for someone to protect their own life before they protect mine. And I don't think that that's a selfish thing. I think that that's the duty of an individual. It's not my job to protect Mrs. Hergert in that type of situation, right? As her husband, it's his job. And so the same thing is true of me, okay? And I think we have to be very careful when we say, it's your responsibility to do this for me. It's not my responsibility to do anything for you. And that almost sounds anti-Christian, but when it comes down to like civic and legal issues, it has to be that way or else it gets extremely muddy. And this is why a lot of people had issues with forced mask mandates. And that it's your responsibility to wear a mask to protect me. It is not my responsibility to protect you. If you feel like you're in danger and you need to wear a mask, please do so. If you feel like you're at risk to the point of you're in grave danger, please stay home. Right? And the best application I can think of that is when people are on chemotherapy treatment and their immune system has dropped severely. Do they walk into King Soopers with a big sign that says, everybody better wear a mask because I'm on chemo? No, they wear a mask or they stay home because it's their responsibility to make sure that they're safe. I don't know all the issues that you get, that all the health issues that you have, and it's not my business to know all the health issues that you have. And as soon as you say it's my responsibility to keep you safe, now I deserve access to all of the ways in which I need to keep you safe. And so I need to know all of your medical history. I need to know all of your mental history, okay? And if we give all of those rights up, whose responsibility is it now? Well, yes, now I feel secure that I don't have to protect myself anymore, but now I've relinquished that to somebody that I actually trust. Do I actually trust them to do that? Natural freedom versus civic freedom. This is, these ideas do not seem like they go together. It's like, the sovereignty of God and the free will of man, that, like, you know that they have to go together, but it's very difficult to explain them. And I've even run into that since I started talking, like 30 minutes ago, where what's the difference between your freedom as an individual to do or say what you believe is true and right and the ability of the government to restrain that? And I think this is why I'm spending so much time on Rousseau. He says it so well. It's the idea of being subject to the general will and being forced to be free. What a strange concept that is. Being forced to be free. Because in anarchy, is that freedom? If you actually break it down, it's not freedom. You don't have the freedom to make decisions freely without worrying about your safety. You don't have the freedom to own property, right? Because anybody at any time can take it. Right? So there are rights that have to be protected by the government, but where does the power of the government stop and the free will of the individual begin? And it's the same exact issue that we have with the sovereignty of God and the free will of man. Does our free will end and the sovereignty of God begin? Well, the sovereignty of God permeates everything. Okay? And so that's one thing that we can't understand. In this situation, we actually have to find a definite point where we say, this is where your freedom stops. And this is where the law begins. Okay? I think one of the famous quotes is, about punching somebody? Yeah, exactly. Yep, so your freedom, basically, your freedom to swing your arm ends at the moment that it hits my face, right? So you can swing your arms all you want, but as soon as you impact other people's freedom, that's when, you know, laws are going to come into play. So, you know, we could talk about this forever, just how these two ideas jive. Freedom within a government versus freedom of the individual. But it's going to be our Constitution that actually lays that out and does so very, very well. Okay, and then lastly, we have Montesquieu. He theorizes about the separation of powers. We don't need to spend a whole lot of time on this because most of you are already familiar with it. These are the three branches of government: judicial, executive, and legislative. So it's odd for us to think about as Americans because we've grown up in a governmental system that has this, and a lot of other countries divide their governments the exact same way, but somebody had to think that up. And Montesquieu is this brilliant man who understands that these three definite powers of any government can become two powers.
And their powers are equal. It's not the same as separate but equal in the Supreme Court case, Plessy versus Ferguson. They talk about segregation, but it's the same idea. They're separate powers, but they're equal in the amount of power that they. So I want you guys to think about whether or not you agree with the ideas of the Enlightenment. Because you agreeing or disagreeing with the Enlightenment is going to impact your ability to agree or disagree with the American Revolution from a legal and historical standpoint, which is the whole idea of why I'm up here teaching. So if you answer no, then you need to, you know, and you can answer no. As I said, this is not a biblical course. Historical and sometimes subjective way of presenting information. If you answer no, then you just have to know that your philosophy is different than the founders. Because they base all of their ideas on all of the people that we already talked about. Right? And that's historically not a problem. It just isn't. Because historically speaking, we can see and we can read all of the things that jive with the idea of the Enlightenment with our founder. Now, they do take kind of piecework from all of those guys from the pilot, but, so for example, they're not going to agree 100% with Thomas Hobbes, right? Because Hobbes advocates for the monarchy. Obviously, the United States, or the American colonies don't agree with that. But his principle of social contract, they do agree with. So they do support very strongly the idea of the Enlightenment. And so you may not support their concept of government, and you certainly are going to question the methods and the means behind the American Revolution, and whether or not they had a right to resist the powers of the British. So if you answer yes, then you're going to have a much easier time understanding the foundation of the American Revolution, and you'll probably become a little bit more cynical and critical of the way that American society is today. The lot of gap in the American psyche between where we are now and where we have come from. And I have a lot of concern when it comes to that, because as a teacher of 15, 16, and 17-year-olds, the amount of knowledge they come to me with is abysmal. It's top to bottom. I mean, you can start with all of the courses. They can't even begin to read anything. Like, it's not even about understanding, they can't even read it. And it's great to have this type of environment where most of you are above the idea of the rock and can understand.
Thank you.
A lot of, you're welcome, that's a big number, I know. No, but you know, I'm just kind of demonstrating just what I'm trying to get. across these ideas to my students, and they can't even begin to understand anything. As soon as they don't know their name, and that's it. But the actual concepts, it's just way over. They can't even read the vocabulary that you've been writing. And I'm not saying go out and read Leviathan or Two Treatises of Government, because you'll fall asleep like that. It's dry, it's hard to read, it's terrible. But it's I would agree with you. But you know, from a like personal perspective, I don't want you guys to go out and read that. I just know that if you open the book and spent time actually attempting to understand or read some of the things that I read, like in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, you would understand what it is that those people are trying to say. Okay. And so if you agree with those Enlightenment philosophers and can kind of absorb that information, then I think either way this is going to be beneficial to you. But you know, if you can absorb the Enlightenment, the ideas of it, then this is going to become so much more clear as to why the founders believed the way that they did, and even why they felt that they had a legal standard to do so. And we do have a few minutes for questions, so I would love to field some of those.
Right along with what you were just saying, I want to clarify something.
Mm-hmm.
At the founding of our country, is it true or not true that the general population tended to be very well educated and literate and were able to comprehend the things? Because you're talking about the contrast between then and now.
Mm-hmm.
You just gave us a graphic example of ignorance not being an insult to the children, but the difference between 250 years ago and now.
Yeah, well, and their ignorance isn't their fault. I mean, at some point when they turn 18, it becomes their fault, right? Especially in the eyes of the law. But at this age, it's not their fault because they've been brought up in the public school system, and the public school system doesn't employ people that are smart. Because people that are smart do other things and make more money. there's little incentive at this point for me to get home. You know, so it's, you just go, I feel so happy. But I even look back 50 years when we heard it. If you would look back at the curriculum, some of the older people that are in this class, this room, some of your curriculum from when you were in fifth grade, my sophomore in high school could not handle it. Especially when it comes down to reading and comprehension, which is the basis for everything that I talk about, right? Because how do we find historical fact? By analyzing primary sources. What are majority primary sources? Writing. And if you can't analyze critically and understand writings and the writings of intelligent people throughout history, you're not going to understand anything about the world that you live in. Right? So, yeah, I mean, it's not even just the people for the most part were higher educated back then. It's that people 50 years ago were higher educated than we are today. And, you know, it's just the loss of knowledge. Yes, sir.